Israeli troops killed a group of paramedics and emergency workers in the Gaza Strip late last month. The Palestinian Red Crescent wants accountability.
It's not enough to comfort us with condolences and nice words. There has to be action taken.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also on the show, a place where global politics fall away, making room for international cooperation.
The space station is a ship at sea, completely cut off from the rest of humanity, physically isolated, that never pulls into port.
Plus, pro basketball flexes in Africa, and in Britain, a new academic focus for some university students.
I wish that this degree had existed when I first started university.
Also, white asparagus, Germans can't get enough.
That's all ahead today on The World.
The Palestinian Red Crescent is asking for an international investigation into the killing of its emergency workers in the Gaza Strip. The first responders came under Israeli fire last month in the southern part of Gaza as they were trying to reach people injured in Israeli strikes. The bodies of the paramedics were found days later in a mass grave, along with the mangled remains of their vehicles.
The Israeli military initially said the rescuers had approached them in a, quote, suspicious way without headlights or emergency signals. But as the world's Shirin Jafari reports, that turned out not to be true.
It's March 23rd, around 4 in the morning. A Palestinian Red Crescent crew is riding in an ambulance in southern Gaza. One of them, Rifat Radwan, is filming the ride. They're frantically searching for colleagues who'd gone to help rescue people from an earlier strike. I hope they're okay. I hope they're okay, Radwan says as he films. We've lost too many of our colleagues, and now we're losing more. The ambulance speeds along, emergency lights flashing. After a few minutes of search, the driver of the ambulance suddenly spots the vehicles of his colleagues on the side of the road.
Hey, Marmi.
They're just lying there, he says. Just lying there, quick. As the men step out of the ambulance to get to their colleagues, they suddenly come under fire. Radwan repeatedly asks God for forgiveness, knowing he won't make it out alive. At one point, he calls on his mother. Forgive me, Mom. Forgive me, Mom. This is the path I chose to help people, he says. His voice starts to trail off as the sound of gunfire can be heard in the background. The world would have known a different version of these moments had it not been for this video, which was released by the Palestinian Red Crescent yesterday. It said the footage was found on the cell phone of Radwan, who was killed that night. The video builds on the testimony of the only surviving emergency worker, Monthar Abed. Speaking to the world's producer in Gaza, the 27-year-old says as soon as he heard the sound of gunshots, he threw himself in the back of the vehicle. He couldn't see what was going on, he says, but could hear the final gasps of his colleagues. Abed says the Israeli soldiers arrested and interrogated him. The following morning, he says, the Israeli soldiers dug huge holes using heavy machinery. They then dumped the bodies and the emergency vehicles into them. The Israeli military said that its forces buried the bodies to prevent them from being eaten by stray dogs and other animals. Last week, Israeli Foreign Minister Gideon Saar said at a press conference that the vehicles didn't have headlights or emergency signals.
Well, the IDF did not randomly attack an ambulance.
Saar also said that an initial investigation revealed that the military killed a Hamas operative called Mohammed Amin Ibrahim Shubaki. He didn't provide any evidence that Shubaki was among the rescue team. Ahmad Dar is sitting at his desk at the Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza. He's in green scrubs and has a look of exhaustion on his face. He tells our producer in Gaza what he saw as he examined the exhumed bodies of several emergency workers who were killed that night. He says some had gunshot wounds in the head. Another one had a bullet enter in the neck and exit through the left side of his mouth. Dar says they still had official uniforms on, recognizable with their reflective stripes. There were clearly Red Crescent and civil defense staff, he says. Why were they killed? Rescue workers, ambulances, hospitals, and their staff are protected under international law. But Israel says Hamas takes advantage of that and hides in medical facilities and uses ambulances to transfer its fighters and weapons.
These 15 men represent all those who were killed for the sake of saving lives, for the sake of humanity.
Yesterday, the head of the Palestinian Red Crescent Society, Yunus al-Khatib, called for an independent investigation into the incident.
It's not enough to comfort us with condolences and nice words. There has to be action taken.
The Israeli military told me that it is conducting an in-depth investigation and will release the results soon. But this is not the first time that it is accused of attacking emergency workers in Gaza. Last year, it reportedly fired at two Red Crescent emergency workers as they tried to reach five-year-old Hind Rajab. Rajab was stranded in her family car after the Israeli military killed six of her family members. She was found dead 12 days later after the military withdrew from that part of Gaza. So far, no one has been held accountable for her death or that of her family or the rescue workers. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
March is the time of year when a lot of us start thinking about spring. Way up north, though, it's when more of the Arctic is frozen over than any other time of year. But last month, the region had its lowest ever sea ice cover for March. This is from new data put out by the European Union's Climate Change Service. Twyla Moon is a scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado. She started by describing what the Arctic usually looks like this time of year.
The Arctic is an ocean surrounded by continents. So if we were looking down on this from space, all of that central Arctic Ocean would be covered by this frozen ocean surface. And that's going to reach down around the eastern coast of Greenland, reach around the northeast parts of Canada, and also down through the passageways between Alaska and Russia and parts of the coast just underneath those kind of northern areas of Russia that lean over towards Alaska.
Thank you for that. I'm looking at a map right now, and that helped me picture it perfectly. So that is a typical year. What about this past March? How did it look different?
This March, we could see substantial bits of sea ice missing north of our Nordic countries and in the Barents Sea. This is kind of the more western part of Russia. And also sea ice missing in that area down between Russia and Alaska and just south of that eastern cusp of Russia that sticks out. We also saw sea ice missing in places between Canada and Greenland.
So obviously this is, you know, a sign of the times, a sign of climate change. What kind of impact does that have on the ground, on the people that live in the Arctic?
Our loss of winter sea ice or reductions in winter sea ice can have a pretty wide range of impacts throughout the Arctic in winter. You have folks who might use it as transportation across the sea ice in order to access hunting grounds, or people might be driving across sea ice in order to go visit friends or family or to do business in other towns or communities. And these kinds of travel routes can become much less stable and certain. So that can get in the way of transportation, hunting, and the normal winter activities. Now, that can have varying results. If you're a person who makes your living off of fishing, you might be happy to have less sea ice and sure, more days that you can take out your fishing boat. If you're a person who really likes taking out your sled dogs, this could be a particularly big challenge, and you're finding less and less good conditions to do that.
Can you talk to me about what impact this might have on, you know, animal ecosystems in the far north?
Well, with animals, there are many animals that live in the Arctic that use sea ice, from creating dens and having pups for seals to polar bears that are going to be using that sea ice as a platform to hunt those seals. And you even have important algae or plants that grow in the sea ice. And so this reduction of sea ice is a real transformation in the ecosystem, which means changes all along that food hierarchy.
If we can expect to see less and less sea ice in the Arctic, what are the long-term effects of that trend beyond what we've already talked about for communities in the north?
Well, some of the long-term impacts of sea ice also reach much further past the Arctic. Sea ice is a really important air conditioner for our planet. And because it's this bright white surface that forms on top of an otherwise really dark ocean, that sea ice also helps to reflect solar radiation or energy back out to space, just like putting on your white tunic when you're going out on a really sunny day. And so the loss of this sea ice is changing the character of the Arctic Ocean and those ecosystems, but it's also changing how much heat that ocean is able to take up because it's not wearing its nice white sea ice cover. And that puts more heat into our global system, which is, of course, something that we're already seeing those impacts as we have more extreme weather events. We have kind of weather whiplash where you might move quickly between drought and flood or hot and cold. And losing sea ice can exacerbate some of these other issues.
I'm wondering what the prognosis is for the Arctic and Arctic sea ice cover. Obviously, this is, you know, an impact of climate change, and cutting carbon emissions will help more sea ice survive. But what is the prognosis for this ecosystem?
Sea ice is an area where we have already seen substantial change. When we think about our timing of minimum sea ice, which usually happens in September, that minimum sea ice extent is already only about 50% of what it was, say, in the 1980s.
Wow.
And so we're seeing more areas of the ocean open up. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's actually easier to access, because you can have big issues with storms, particularly big waves, fog, and you still have this smaller bits of mobile sea ice that can get in the way. But we do anticipate the possibility for an essentially ice-free Arctic during that late summertime within the next decades.
Twyla Moon is a scientist with the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Colorado.
Meanwhile, the same warmer temperatures that are melting sea ice also drove up demand for electricity to power air conditioning. A report released today put some new numbers on that. Last year, global electricity demand went up 4% compared to the year before, and people's need to stay cool accounted for more than 1/6 of that total increase.
Just to put that in perspective, that's the electricity demand of a medium-sized country that heatwaves added in 2024.
That's Nicholas Fulgham, who helped write a new clean energy report for the think tank Ember.
The problem is that that increase in electricity demand needs to be met by a matching increase in supply.
There was record growth in renewable energy sources last year, but it could not power all of those ACs going at full blast.
We therefore did see more of an increase in fossil generation than would have otherwise been necessary.
Hotter temperatures mean burning more fossil fuels, which means more greenhouse gases. So yeah, vicious cycle. Heat waves were an especially big driver of energy use in India, the U.S., and China.
In China, we always see an increase in demand from year to year just because the economy is growing. But that increase, for example, in August and September was doubled because temperatures were significantly higher than in the previous year. So it can have a huge impact.
Emissions of planet-warming greenhouse gases once again hit record highs last year, though it is notable that solar energy had a banner year, and renewables plus nuclear power plants generated more than 40% of the world's electricity for the first time in many decades.
You're with the world. This is the world. I'm Marco Werman. As we just heard, climate change is impacting our present, and it will also reshape our future. If you're entering adulthood and looking down that road, you're well acquainted with the constant reminders.
An alarming leap in global temperatures, bringing the world dangerously close to a critical climate change threshold.
That sea level is rising twice as fast now as it was just 25 years ago because all of that ice is melting so fast.
The world is sitting on a razor's edge.
It makes sense that young people want to do something about it. At universities, the traditional major of environmental studies is still popular. But in the UK, there's one university offering a new degree with a sharper focus. The World's Bianca Hillier has our story.
Will Locke has been teaching about climate change at Sussex University, south of London, since 2019. He says students can't get enough.
Many of our students have increasingly asked for more climate teaching. And interestingly, they've wanted to learn about climate change from a range of disciplines as well. So they want to kind of learn from different approaches, different ways of thinking about the climate crisis.
In fact, a recent UK survey found that 72% of teenagers want more relevant and rigorous climate change education. Now, Sussex is answering that call with a new degree called Climate Justice, Sustainability and Development.
It's not a traditional undergraduate degree where you might learn a set of knowledge, right, that is kind of agreed upon in advance. If you want to become a scholar in this area, you should know this theorist, this theorist, this theorist.
That's because the expertise and the problems this degree is built to address are in flux.
We're thinking about the broader set of knowledge, skills, attitudes, values that a student might need in the changing world that we're seeing.
Many colleges and universities offer climate justice courses, and at some schools, you can even get a certificate. But this program at Sussex is believed to be the first full-fledged undergraduate degree on climate justice. Locke says he thinks of the new degree as training the next generation of activists.
Activists in this much broader sense that are not just comfortable on the streets demanding change, but comfortable in the halls of power, comfortable in conference halls, comfortable in boardrooms, wherever it might be, feeling comfortable and confident that you can drive change.
I wished this degree had existed when I first started university.
Tabby Kazanov, a Sussex senior, served as the student liaison to help design the degree. She hopes graduates will be able to bridge the gap between industries and disciplines, as well as people.
I think that the climate justice debate is a very polarizing one, and it's one that we just don't have time to be arguing over. It's too urgent.
Jack Cooper is another senior at Sussex. He got his start in climate activism as a teenager, and at first, his methods weren't so academic. He wanted to disrupt things. He once pretended to glue himself to a goalpost in the middle of a major soccer game wearing a shirt that read, "Just Stop Oil." Now, he sees value in appealing to the majority.
And that's based around acting in communities, workplaces, schools.
Cooper expects the degree's interdisciplinary approach to climate change will attract a more diverse group of students.
And the hope is this can create a movement in the UK where climate and nature is not something which is a fringe concern.
He also appreciates that the program is taking a modern approach to learning. For example, students can expect to get their hands dirty in gardens and be assigned listening to podcasts instead of reading textbooks.
These things are increasingly gaining more respect as ways of communicating these ideas, but I think there's still a lot of entrenched ideas that you need to be giving students hundreds of pages of academic reading to do.
Will Locke, the professor who helped spearhead the new program, says students won't only be listening to podcasts, they'll be producing them too. Because, he says, climate justice education is nothing without public communication.
And that's something that is useful for them as a person in terms of building skills, but also looks great to an employer to say, hey, I've done this in a way that's not just repeating dead white theorists.
The first cohort will start the new degree at Sussex in September 2026. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In Germany, it's Spargelzeit, or as we would say in English, asparagus season. This is white asparagus we're talking about, not green, and Germans are just a little bit obsessed. Michael Bruckmann runs a restaurant in Beilitz, Germany, an area outside Berlin that's famous for its white asparagus harvest.
Germans are really going crazy about the white asparagus. White asparagus is essentially pampered.
Pampered.
I mean, it takes a lot of labor intensity. It's not like you just grow it and let the plant do this work. Is they have those little hills where the plant is under, and it always needs to be kept under the earth, under the soil, is almost away from the sunlight, basically. It's similar to a mushroom. And then you have a three layer of different foils on it to keep it really warm, the plant, but don't keep it too warm. It needs to be still by hand. You have workers on the field by rain, by sun. I'll be talking about 8,000 hectares of asparagus fields.
So this white asparagus is very pampered. It is, you said, kept in little earthen mounds to prevent it from turning green. And then it has these like tents over it to keep it warm. What does it taste like and what's the texture like for those who haven't tried it?
It's a bit buttery. It's not as earthy, I would say, as the green asparagus. It's a bit more grassy, I would say.
So a more delicate flavor than the green asparagus.
I mean, if you hear German talking about it, especially if they talk about Spargel or asparagus season, it's like they're talking about buried treasures. It's a serious culture here.
Yeah, it's serious. You're saying it's treasured. Can you tell me more about what that looks like? I was in Germany one spring and remember like banners on the sides of restaurants advertising Spargel and menus that had it in almost every dish in the springtime. Tell me how people eat it. What are the most traditional preparations?
As the main courses, we do have the classic portion is just 400 grams of asparagus with some potatoes and then the sauce of your choice, or what lots of Germans, they love the schnitzel.
Of course.
It's asparagus with schnitzel, or the bratwurst, where you have bratwurst and it's flavored with asparagus. But I would say that would take more the green asparagus. That's what we do here as well. It's more flavor intense and a bit more earthy.
You mentioned the different sauces that you could choose. I understand there's some serious debate in Germany over which sauce is appropriate with white asparagus. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so there's lots of people. I mean, you have team hollandaise, you got team clarified butter, which is a bernoisette, got a bit of a nuttier taste to it. Or then you got the other team, which is undecided between butter and adding some breadcrumbs to it. I'm more team hollandaise.
You're team hollandaise. And how long will asparagus season last?
It's usually the cutoff would be the 21st of June. But I haven't said that. And now with global warming, we're starting earlier. And therefore, you need to give some time as well for the plant to regenerate, because you need 5 years for the first asparagus to grow.
Wow.
After planting it, it takes 5 years. Then you have another 5 years where you can actually harvest it. And then after, you take all the minerals, all the asparagus plant did take out all the minerals off the soil. So you bury it and then you have to start somewhere else growing again.
Michael Bruchmann runs a restaurant in Beilitz, Germany, outside of Berlin. This is The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. A U.S. citizen and three EU nationals are facing possible deportation from Germany. The four have been told to leave the country by April 21st. Authorities in Berlin say this is tied to a protest at a university last October against the war in Gaza. Those facing deportation and their lawyer say it's really about silencing dissent. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
Protests against the war in Gaza have been happening across Germany since the Hamas attack on October 7th, and they're often heavily policed. Law enforcement broke up this protest in Berlin in February after demonstrators chanted in Arabic. Only German or English slogans are allowed at these marches. In the past months, authorities in Berlin seem to be taking things a step further.
Basically, the four of us have been issued with this deportation notice, which stipulates that we're such a threat to the country currently that we have to leave the country by April 21st.
Irish national Roberta Murray is one of the four facing deportation. No one in the group has been convicted of any crime, Murray told Irish Radio a few days ago. Alexander Gorski is a lawyer representing the group.
We haven't seen the criminal file, so we don't know the concrete accusations.
The four include two Irish citizens, one Polish national, and 27-year-old Cooper Longbottom from Seattle.
For M. Cooper, who is a US citizen and who is trans, obviously the thought of not being able to stay in Berlin, not continuing their studies, and having to go back to the US with its heavy anti-trans legislation happening at the moment is scary.
Berlin's interior ministry told me the deportation orders were issued in relation to a demonstration at the Free University of Berlin last October. During the event, masked protesters forcibly entered a college building and caused significant property damage, the ministry said, along with other criminal offences. The protests made national headlines at the time.
Das Ganze ist massiv, es ist kriminell, es ist ein Angriff auf die freie Universität.
It's criminal, the university's president Gunther Ziegler told reporters. It's an attack on the university and our mission to foster dialogue. But with no criminal convictions, the threat of deportation is raising a lot of eyebrows. Deporting an EU citizen from an EU country usually only happens when someone is accused of a very serious crime and is seen as a danger to the public. Emails released last week show that the German immigration authorities disagreed with the demand by Berlin's interior ministry to deport the four, but they were overruled. Lawyer Alexander Gorski believes the decision is mainly political.
I think the Berlin government wanted to set an example so that everyone who doesn't have a German passport knows what can happen if you participate in pro-Palestine activism.
Germany has taken a tougher line on pro-Palestinian protests than most EU countries. The Berlin government in particular has called some of the protests anti-Semitic. Uffe Jensen is deputy director of the Center for Research on Antisemitism at the Technical University in Berlin.
There is really serious concern about anti-Semitism in Germany.
Incidents of anti-Semitism have soared since October 7th, Jensen says. And Germany, because of the Holocaust, views protecting Jewish communities as a national duty. But crackdowns on Gaza protests, he says, appear to be about much more than that.
The government in Berlin is headed by a right-wing conservative politician, and I view it as an attempt to show a rather authoritarian version of politics against groups that they feel threaten Jews and threaten Israel.
Jensen says universities in Germany haven't been as heavy-handed as what appears to be happening in the US. But the police response has sometimes been more aggressive than the colleges expected. And that's creating a climate of fear, he says.
Many of the students that have been protesting in my university, some of them are German citizens, but there are also students from Syria, for example, or from Lebanon who are here on a visa. And for them, it's dangerous. They are very scared.
Germany has been broadly supportive of Israel since the October 7th attacks. Incoming Chancellor Friedrich Merz said recently he'd welcome the Israeli Prime Minister to Berlin. Roberta Murray, the Irish citizen who's facing deportation, says they will not be silenced.
As far as I'm concerned, it's business as usual out on the streets. The genocide hasn't stopped, so we have to keep fighting.
All four are appealing their deportation orders. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, has lots of critical minerals, and the Trump administration wants in on them. The White House advisor on Africa, Massad Boulos, met with Congo's president, Felix Tshisekedi, last week in Kinshasa. Afterwards, Boulos said the two had agreed on a path forward on a deal that would give American companies more control of those mineral assets. In exchange, the U.S. would provide additional backing to the DRC government, which is mired in civil war in eastern Congo, where most of those minerals are located. Jason Stearns is the director of the Congo Research Group at New York University. We reached him in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, and asked him what he knows about this proposed deal.
Well, we don't know very much. It's still very early days. What we know is that both sides are open to a deal. The Congolese government, as you suggested, wants an end to the war in the eastern Congo. That means, in particular, the withdrawal of Rwandan troops from the eastern DRC. And the U.S. government would like access to the very plentiful Congolese critical minerals. Congo has enormous amounts of minerals, in particular minerals useful for the green energy transition. It's the largest producer of copper in Africa. It's the largest producer of cobalt in the world, around 70%. And that's a mineral that's critical for the electric vehicle supply chain for the batteries. Other than that, I don't think we know very much. And having spoken with both sides, the Congolese and the Americans involved in this, Everybody tells me that it's very early days.
Right. Is it clear if American companies would actually be overseeing mining operations in the DRC? Is that detail clear to you?
No, but there are very few details clear at all. But what we can say is that there are no U.S. large U.S. mining companies in the DRC at the moment. There was just a deal struck with Cobalt, which is a mining company that has Jeff Bezos and Bill Gates as investors. But that deal is just struck, so the mining there hasn't started. But there are no U.S. mining companies for a good reason. Both governance as well as the infrastructure situation in the DRC are not ideal. That means there's a lot of corruption. There's not a lot of electricity and roads, right, making mining very difficult. So most of the mines are actually in Chinese hands in the DRC at the moment.
And what about the Democratic Republic of Congo? Based on what we know, what would the government there get out of this deal?
Well, there's been some crazy things floated that I wouldn't give too much credence for. They've asked for U.S. troops on the ground. I really don't think that is in the cards. But I think the Congolese government needs the U.S. to get more involved and put pressure on Rwanda. Rwanda has been backing a rebel group in the eastern DRC called the M23. That M23 rebellion started around 3.5 years ago and has received extensive backing from the Rwandan government. In fact, much of the fighting is being done by Rwandan troops on Congolese soil. So what Congolese want is the U.S. to put pressure on the Rwandans. The Rwandans are a relatively aid-dependent country. They're vulnerable to international pressure. So if the U.S. really wanted to strong-arm them, they could.
I mean, you make a really good point there. I mean, if the U.S. is trying to negotiate a deal with the government of the DRC for getting access for American companies to those minerals, somehow security has to come into play because there is a civil war there in eastern Congo. So what is the security plan?
So the eastern DRC, where the conflict is taking place and where you have not just the M23, but roughly 100 different armed groups, most of the mining there is actually artisanal mining. That's pick and shovel mining. Most of the big industrial mines are in the south of the country. At the moment, that's still a long way away from where the conflict is. But I think you raise a valid point, which is, you know, if Tshisekedi signs this deal today with the U.S. government, and then the M23 end up taking the areas, especially the mining hubs, or if the M23 keep on advancing and the Tshisekedi government falls, I mean, we're still a long way away from that, but it's a possibility, then why sign this deal with the Congolese government at all? So I think there's a lot. I think this is far from a done deal, in other words.
All right, so break it down here. Who is controlling access to these minerals right now in eastern Congo? Like, if this plan pushes through, who do Trump and Tshisekedi have to go through to get control of those minerals?
Well, the minerals that the U.S. is interested in are copper and cobalt at the moment. Those minerals are still in Congolese government hands. In fact, most of them are tied up in the south of the country and are being mined by foreign companies, especially Chinese. One of the difficulties of this arrangement would be that some of these Chinese companies might have to agree that some of their minerals would have to go into U.S. stockpiles. This is, I think, another reason this is so interesting for the U.S. government, because the Chinese government actually depends on a lot of these supply chains. They need the copper and the cobalt as well for their manufacturing industry. So they could kill two birds with one stone. They could get their own strategic stockpile and they could prevent the Chinese from getting it.
Jason, when it comes to what's best for the Congolese people, what's your expert opinion of this proposed deal based on what you know?
Well, what's best for the Congolese people is for Rwanda to stop backing an intervention in the eastern DRC. That would be, I think, relatively easy to orchestrate. If Rwanda withdrew its support to the M23 rebellion, I think within a very short period of time, you'd see the conflict de-escalate. In terms of a minerals deal, I think what the Congolese people need is for these minerals actually to provide value to their own economy and to their own growth. Most of the profit for these minerals go to multinational corporations abroad. But first and foremost, what the Congolese people need is an end to the violence. There are currently almost 7 million people displaced in the eastern DRC, 1 million this year alone because of the violence. So I think that's the priority.
Jason Stearns is the director of the Congo Research Group, speaking with us today from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
And now for a few fancy things in the news that you might have missed.
A Belgian prince has lost his legal fight to win Social Security benefits. He'd been asking for those benefits on top of his royal allowance of $424,000 a year. Prince Laurent, who said he was acting out of principle rather than for the money, argued that his duties as a prince entitled him to the coverage given independent entrepreneurs. But the court said no, deciding that he's really more of a civil servant. And in Belgium, civil servants don't actually get full Social Security benefits.
And from a prince to a queen bee that is, scientists think there may be something special in a queen's biology. She has nearly identical DNA to a worker bee, but she lives for years instead of just a few months. British researchers are angling for funding to find out why that's the case, hoping to eventually unlock therapies to extend human fertility and lifespans.
And it appears a Brazilian judge spent 23 years working under a false identity, and quite the upper crust one at that. The man who said he was a son of English aristocrats called himself Edward Albert Lancelot Dodd, Canterbury Caterham Wickfield. The now-retired judge was outed when he went to renew his government ID card, and officials found that his birth certificate and fingerprints matched those of a Brazilian man named Dos Reis. Now, Dos Reis is being charged with identity fraud. Police have not managed to make an arrest in this case because the suspect of many names disappeared.
And those are a few things you might have missed in the news. The first time he stepped onto an NBA court for a game in 1984, Hakeem Olajuwon made an impact.
Lucas at the other end, behind his back, fancy, Olajuwon.
24 points and 9 rebounds. What an opening game for the rookie from Houston.
Hakeem, the Dream, was originally from Lagos, Nigeria. He was the first African player to join the NBA. This year, the season opened with a record number of players from the continent, where interest and investment in basketball continues steady growth and popularity. From the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Brianna Duggan reports on one of the newest teams to make it into Africa's elite basketball league.
On a Friday night in Nairobi, this stadium is standing room only. Around 1,000 people are packed in to watch Mombasa's Kenya Ports Authority play against the local team, the Nairobi City Thunder. Dressed in a Thunder cap, Thunder shirt, shoulders draped in a Thunder flag, is Fred Salawa, a.k.a.
Many people knows me like Wingman, fan number one Thunder. Yeah, that's my name.
Wingman clearly isn't the only super fan.
I think it was somewhere halfway through the first season where we realized, oh my God.
Colin Rasmussen is a co-founder of Kenya's Twende Sports, which runs the Thunder.
There's so much desire for this product beyond the players themselves and beyond the people, you know, the coaches, et cetera, that are immediately involved. There's a whole ecosystem of people that, you know, people that never used to watch basketball coming to the games.
Kenya is known globally for its marathoners. Rugby is big, but the most popular game is soccer. Basketball has lacked facilities, investment, and fans. Mashara Woch stands courtside. He moved to Nairobi from a smaller town 3 years ago.
The first team that caught my eyes was Nairobi City Thunder. So I start supporting it because they have good ball. They inspire me. At first I used to play football, but then when I saw Thunder playing, I changed sport. So I switched to basketball.
In December, the Nairobi City Thunder made history, becoming the first Kenyan team to make it to the Basketball Africa League, or BAL. That's the pro league run by the NBA and the International Basketball Federation, which played its first season in 2021. It returns for its fourth season this month and is made up of a dozen teams from countries including Angola, Nigeria, Egypt, Rwanda. Thunder has stood out beyond its basketball skills. An all-professional basketball team with competitive salaries and health insurance, it's a rarity in Kenya. But today, as other teams watch Thunder's success, assistant coach Rose Mushila says expectations are shifting.
It really is a great time to be part of the basketball ecosystem. Teams are starting to try and level up. They're really putting in the work. Coaches are stepping up. Athletes are putting in the work as well. The culture has changed around what the sport means, what the competition level is.
A basketball athlete's typical route to success was, well, go overseas. For Twende's Colin Rasmussen, it's not about building the next star for export.
I do believe there will be a Kenyan NBA player in the future. However, for us, it's much more important that we're creating opportunity for a wider group of young Kenyans and East Africans in general. We wanted to start something that really created opportunities here in Africa, not just for the extremely talented, but for anybody that really wants to have a career and pursue sports.
When players stick around, it can have a knock-on effect. Garang Ding is one of Thunder's top players.
I watched my teammate play when I was young, Tyler, so I'd say it was really special for me watching him even on the screens, the big screens in the Europe and the US. But what about if I stay in Africa and have as much impact as possible. Like, we also see, like, we have a lot of kids around Africa. The population is rising, and we've got very young kids who are starting to play the game. So being able to inspire, like, many kids in Africa will be really special for me.
The game goes into overtime. There's less than a minute left. Ding throws it down, bringing the arena to its feet and giving the Thunder a comfortable win.
6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
However, no matter who won tonight's game, the real winner may just be Kenya's basketball future. For The World, I'm Brianna Duggan in Nairobi.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Here was the scene this morning, some 250 miles above the South Pacific.
So we're standing by momentarily for the opening of the hatch to the Soyuz MS-27 spacecraft.
NASA scientists at the Johnson Space Center were following along from Houston.
Behind that hatch, Soyuz Commander Sergei Ryzhikov, NASA astronaut Johnny Kim, and Roscosmos cosmonaut Alexei Zubritsky. And the hatch now is open.
And with that, a U.S. astronaut and two Russian cosmonauts floated through that hatch into the International Space Station, where they joined the crew already on board. Someone on the ground interprets the introductions.
Yes, we hope that now that we have one more crew, we'll continue working. Wishing you good luck and success.
It's proof that despite all the geopolitical tensions gripping much of the world, global cooperation in the cosmos is still happening, at least for now. Chris Hadfield is a retired astronaut and former ISS commander. His latest novel is titled Final Orbit. It comes out in October. We spoke earlier, and I asked him what was going through his mind as he watched today's events in space.
Well, it's almost impossible to do, both technically and geopolitically. And yet, in face of all kinds of obstacles, and every single country that has been participating in the International Space Station has at some point over the last 25 years tried to back out of it, just because it's really hard to maintain something for a quarter century. And yet, even though it flies in face of all logic and other kinds of activities, it continues to fly. And if you take it for granted, you'd be a fool.
So there is international cooperation on Earth to make stuff happen in space. Let me ask you about international collaboration in space on the ISS. What sort of language and cultural barriers did you run into up there?
There are 15 different nations that are all part of the International Space Station. So multiple different languages and cultures and religions, you know, and all of those you need to be really sensitive to. I was commander of the International Space Station, and you train for years. We train internationally. We train in Japan, in Russia, in Europe, in Canada, across the United States. And you get to really know the people that you might have a chance to fly with. But the filter that selects astronauts or cosmonauts is pretty similar no matter which of those 15 countries it is. And so the type of people that end up on the space station have a lot more in common than maybe you might think their nationality of birth would separate them. But also, we count on each other with our lives. One mistake and you threaten the lives of everybody else on board. And one other thing, we don't live by Earth's laws there. I mean, which country would we choose? We actually live by a document called the International Crew Code of Conduct that has been agreed to and signed by all member states. And it's kind of an interesting precursor for how we'll settle the moon and what laws will be on the moon. And the space station, therefore, is quite an unusual human construct.
Well, what are the conditions on the ISS that make cooperation more likely up there than here on Earth?
The space station is a ship at sea, completely cut off from the rest of humanity, physically isolated, that never pulls into port. We get lots of help and advice from Earth, but we are a little microcosm of humanity. We are threatened by the very place that we live. It's a deathly environment just on the other side of the inflated aluminum hull. And we're trying to run the vehicle, conduct the 200 experiments, and execute the mission that we've all been chosen for. So there's a real commonality of purpose, and it's just a bunch of people, but they're not random people. And when I was commander, you know, you want to be very careful, not only technically supporting everybody, but psychologically supporting everybody on board. One of them might lose a family member while we're up there. And in fact, during my crew, one of my crewmates' mother died. Wow. And so, you know, that level of interpersonal support. And you can't leave. You cannot come home just because you feel like it. And so we work very hard to respect each other, to try and be not only a very productive research laboratory, but also a very productive human experiment, a little nodule of geopolitics away from the noise of the world.
How much does that affect your behavior and just kind of point of view when you get back to Earth?
When you come back from a mission like that, it's not just the 6 months you spent on the International Space Station that has formed you, but it is the years of training, the years of learning each other's languages and each other's cultures, the time spent living in each other's countries, and the shared joys and sorrows of the life of an astronaut on Earth. I was an astronaut. I served for 21 years. I was only in space for 6 months. So I spent 20 and a half years developing the technical skills, but also building the bonds and the friendships and the foundations of psychological support that would allow us to succeed.
Just practically speaking, Chris, right now there are 10 people on board the space station, 4 Americans, 5 Russians, and a Japanese astronaut. They're living in about 2,400 square feet. How claustrophobic is that when you're up there?
We don't live in square feet. We live in cubic feet without gravity.
Of course
you do. And it makes a huge difference. Nobody stands on the floor. Imagine in the studio that you're sitting in right now, Marco, if you were completely free to float to the ceiling or up or any direction,
so cool.
The room, it's so cool. But also, the room becomes much bigger. You're not all squished into the floor like we are on Earth. And so you can go half a day on the space station and not see another person. So you can be working way down the end of one module on an experiment for half a day, and you don't hear or think of or even see anyone else. They're busy doing what they're doing. It's a little bit like living in a monastery laboratory, maybe, is what it sort of feels like up there. Very purposeful. You do relax, you know, occasionally watch a movie. If someone has a birthday or someone on Earth, we'll get together for dinner, and there's a guitar up there so we can sing the songs from our countries. And, it, you know, there's that great sense of camaraderie. But there's also a great sense of mutual respect and allowing people to be themselves. You need to have that reserve and that respect for each other.
I see 15,000 cubic feet is what you're living in. So that's, yeah.
Also, Marco, you can float to the window and you can go from San Diego to Boston in 9 minutes. You go around the entire world in 90 minutes. And if you have that huge volume inside and you have a magic power, like you can fly because you're weightless, and you can float to the window and watch an entire continent go by in the time it takes to drink a cup of coffee, for me, it's the opposite of claustrophobia. You're free to see the entire world.
That's amazing. Retired astronaut Chris Hadfield is a former commander on the International Space Station.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston.
And from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We're at theworld.org online. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening, and we will see you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider, and Marianne Tagney. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.